Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this conference on disinformation and democracy. We have gathered experts, researchers, the media, about the dissemination of fake or manipulated information. We expect to hold a dynamic session. We have given about 10 minutes to each of the speakers, and we are counting on a very engaged and fruitful discussion. We have today with us Delphine Collard, representative of the European Parliament. She is responsible for answering the questions from the media and provides to the members of the parliament concrete information to address these topics. Inés Sousa Guedes has a PhD in criminology by the University of Port, and she's the director of the Crime School of the Faculty of Law of the University of Porto. Luisa Meirelles, since 2018, head of the Lusa News Agency. And then, last but not least, José Pacheco Pereira. He is a politician, well known as a politician, but also an historian. And I begin by giving the floor to the Vice President of the Parliament, Rodrigo Saraiva. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Allow me to start by greeting the members of this panel with these illustrious speakers, and also welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this conference. The current times in this country, our community, celebrating 50 years of our democracy. In 1975, we celebrated 3 Ds, but today we are discussing 2 Ds, disinformation that we need to fight against and democracy, which we are still fighting for. Every day we need to preserve this big D that unites us all, which is democracy. So to discuss information is also to discuss truth and choices. In a liberal democracy, freedom is not decreed. It results from the free exchange of ideas and individual responsibility. This is why disinformation is not only a technical problem or a communicational problem. It is a structural, it is key for any democratic regime. Allow me to clarify a misrepresentation. Disinformation did not occur with press or the social media. Ever since we have had organized political organizations, has there been disinformation. Ever since we have had democracy, there has been an attempt to distort deliberately reality. In the 20th century, we have seen how totalitarian propaganda has challenged true information. During the Cold War, we saw these practices, but this is not a new phenomenon. Nowadays, a false narrative can be created in a continent, amplified in another, and internationalized in a third in just a few hours. It can be reinforced by automated networks, triggered by AI with a high degree of realism. But there is even a deeper transformation. We no longer live in an environment of too much information, but rather fragmentation of authority. For many decades, the public sphere was concentrated. There were reference media, established professional rules and information circulated within a more limited space. Nowadays, anyone can produce allegedly true information. Any document can be simulated. We have arrived in an area where visual proof is no longer sufficient. And this is a danger to a democratic environment, because democracy depends on a minimum of a consensus. We can have different outlooks on the roles of the government, but if we don't agree on basic facts, then it is not possible to debate. And disinformation tries to create an environment of uncertainty and says that everything is relative, everything is manipulated, and nothing is reliable. And when nothing is reliable, then a part of the population no longer believes in the institution. This is where disinformation crosses with hybrid war that is used as strategic weapon, where internal weaknesses are exploited and conspiracies are fed into. Disinformation is very hard to attribute formally, and it's a very efficient weapon. But not all information comes from outside. Often it occurs within democratic societies. It is born from extreme polarization and from deliberate propagation of fear. And this is why disinformation cannot only be externalized, it's also an internal channel, a challenge of democratic maturity. So the question is, how can we respond to it? And in my view, the first response is literacy. Literacy, media literacy, digital literacy, political literacy, and also economic literacy. Literacy is not only technical, but also cultural. It implies teaching about healthy doubt and teaching that not everything that confirms our convictions is necessarily true. Disinformation prospers in ignorance, and all of us as citizens are accountable. Every hasty sharing may be a danger to the public space. In a free regime, the quality of debate depends on the quality of its participants. Another important dimension is the role of the press, and I'm certain that Louise will provide invaluable inputs to this discussion. The fourth power is not only an adornment. It is one of our weapons against institutionalized lies. But the mediatic ecosystem is under pressure with unequal competition with other platforms. And if we do not guarantee independent, strong journalism, then we will leave a space for noise, manipulation, and not very transparent interests. So to defend the press means protecting democracy itself. The third dimension is technology. Generative AI, deepfakes represent a whole new frontier. We are talking about hyper-realistic videos, simulated voices, images that cannot be distinguished from reality, and this requires international cooperation and requires technical capacity of authorities. But we need to be very attentive here. The fight against disinformation cannot be used as a control mechanism that can be used against freedom itself. The line is very thin and must be based on democratic prudence. Censorship is not at all the solution. The fourth dimension is institutional. Public institutions need to communicate better. They need to explain decisions. They must acknowledge mistakes when they make them. Opacity creates suspicion. So to reinforce transparency is also one way of preventing disinformation. And lastly, the risk of social fatigue. When citizens are constantly exposed to noise, they become tired, and fatigue generates indifference, which is a danger to democracy. And it becomes difficult to distinguish between what is truly serious from just noise. Ladies and gentlemen, democracy is truly a very demanding regime. It requires time, critical thought, and responsibility, accountability. It is not compatible with instantaneous indignation and critical virality. It requires more maturity, more education, more literacy, more personal accountability, more institutional transparency, independent journalism, and international cooperation. If we respond with censorship, then we will betraying our principles. If we become indifferent, we will weaken our regime. But if we react with citizen responsibility, we will strengthen democracy. So resilience is a test to our capacity to adapt institutions without giving up on values. It is a test to the soundness of the rule of law. And I'm certain that today's discussion will deliver concrete, valuable solutions. The reinforcement of literacy is the best tool in the defense of a stronger, more demanding democracy. Thank you very much. I wish you an excellent debate.
Thank you, Vice President, for your words, and let us begin. And I'll give the floor to our guest, Delphine Collard.
Caros presidentes, membros do Parlamento, do Secretário-Geral, distintos convidados. Muito obrigada pela oportunidade de falar aqui, de falar da experiência que nós recolhemos no Parlamento Europeu sobre esta matéria, da manipulação da informação. A informação é um bem comum, que é também frágil. O espaço global digital de informação é uma arena, é um terreno de batalha. A democracia parlamentar está sob pressão dos atores totalitários, mas também dos atores empresariais que querem maximizar os seus ganhos. A manipulação da informação é utilizada como instrumento não apenas para apresentar a sua própria, afirmar a sua própria visão da sociedade, mas também para, e quando as palavras do vice-presidente, para desorientar, para retirar a base comum da confiança das nossas democracias. A Presidente Roberto Mazzola disse no Parlamento que a desinformação continua a alterar a nossa realidade partilhada e, mais preocupantemente, cada vez mais pessoas no nosso continente questionam se a democracia ainda funciona, se votar, se vale a pena o esforço. E estas palavras têm muito a ver com aquilo que o Sr. Vice-Presidente acabou de dizer, que é a fadiga da informação criada no nosso ecossistema. Nós vimos aquilo que pode levar com os ataques físicos que tivemos no Capitólio dos Estados Unidos ou tomar do Parlamento brasileiro. Pode haver uma violência física das teorias da conspiração, da desinformação, da manipulação da informação. E ao longo dos anos vimos também que há campanhas brutais de informação que prepararam terreno para a invasão ilegal da Ucrânia pela Rússia. Vimos também as táticas de desinformação a tentarem perturbar as nossas eleições em vários Estados-membros, e foi a Eslovénia com os deepfakes de voz. Os Países Baixos recentemente tiveram a experiência de que os cidadãos pediam informações chatbox do IA para conselhos de como votar, e eram-lhes apresentadas visões distorcidas da realidade neerlandesa. Por isso, os regimes autocráticos estão a afinar os seus instrumentos para manipular a opinião pública, para garantir ganhos políticos e, simultaneamente, desenvolvem a oportunidade de desenvolvimento para as grandes empresas de tecnologia que nos colocam desafios a nós, cidadãos, e às democracias abertas, porque a forma como estas novas tecnologias estão a ser desenvolvidas afetam a forma como nós consumimos as notícias, a forma como nós acedemos a conteúdos específicos e, também foi dito, a informação gerada pela IA está a aumentar exponencialmente os nossos estudos. Verificámos que antes das eleições tivemos mais 4 ou 5% de desinformação do que vinha da inteligência artificial. E agora, esse número, nos estudos mais recentes, situa-se a 20%. E são os deepfakes e as contas falsas, mas é também disseminação maciça através da IA. E o professor irá falar, certamente, sobre a evolução das tecnologias na sua apresentação. Também está a criar novas situações para os jornalistas, e o meu homólogo irá também falar sobre isso, certamente, porque é mais rápido ter cópias baratas dos jornalistas, e também há canais de desinformação em massa, e há também o silenciamento dos jornalistas. O que é que isto tem a ver com os parlamentos e, sobretudo, com o Parlamento Europeu? Nós estamos na linha da frente das democracias liberais representativas, e aquilo que nós vemos é que, sim, as eleições podem ser tomadas como alvo, e é isso que nós vemos. Tem a ver com criar dúvidas sobre as questões técnicas da votação, ou dar instruções falsas de voto, roubar temas de grande, no perfil muito saliente, criando desinformação, espalhando o desencorajamento e a dúvida. E aquilo que nós vemos atualmente é que não acontece apenas à volta dos períodos eleitorais, acontece durante todo o período legislativo. Está a influenciar os debates, as votações. Há sempre uma tentativa de ter um impacto sobre a tomada de decisão. No Parlamento Europeu, para dar um exemplo muito concreto, nós vemos, por exemplo, tivemos o Kremlin a retratar o Parlamento como sendo absolutamente irrelevante e, simultaneamente, quando o Parlamento adotou uma resolução dizendo que a Rússia era patrocinador do terrorismo em 23, nessa mesma semana tivemos reações oficiais e também ataques não oficiais e manipulação de informação. Ataques feitos ao Parlamento Europeu. Tivemos uma história completamente falsa de uma campanha, e uma campanha a dizer que o Parlamento estava a receber martelos cobertos em sangue, uma imagem muito, muito violenta. Nós temos pessoas a dizer que o Parlamento Europeu está a fazer censura quando a pessoa está a falar, o deputado está a falar durante demasiado tempo e lhe é retirado o microfone. Isto é retirado do contexto e é apresentado como uma forma de silenciar, entre aspas, as vozes que se opõem. E quando se cria uma comissão para trabalhar sobre a defesa da democracia, isto é apresentado pelos atores como uma alegação de que a União Europeia está a assumir poderes totalitários para derrubar as eleições nacionais. Isto é o tipo de histórias que nós vemos no Parlamento Europeu, para não referir os ataques aos membros individuais, aos deputados, que podem ser alvo de fakes baratos, que podem fazer mal às suas reputações. Isto acontece porquê? Porque nós seguimos, temos democracias abertas, nós valorizamos a liberdade de expressão, a troca de opiniões, os debates, quando há diferentes visões da sociedade que se confrontam. E, por isso, os elementos que nós partilhamos tornam-nos vulneráveis simultaneamente e temos que preservar, temos que os preservar. O que é que pode ser feito quando os Estados-membros trabalham muito intimamente com as instituições nesta matéria e a situação não é positiva, mas já muita coisa foi feita? A legislação de diretivas sobre a liberdade de informação para proteger a liberdade da imprensa, para proteger os jornalistas de processos judiciais abusivos. Mas isto vai muito para além disso. Nós estamos a trabalhar agora sobre um novo escudo de proteção. Estão a ser feitas recomendações e está a ser criada uma legislação, porque essa legislação existe não para censurar, como vê-se muito bem, é para aumentar a liberdade de expressão e empoderar os cidadãos para que eles possam escolher aquilo que querem ver online e que se possam proteger quando essas plataformas estão a abusar os direitos de livre circulação de informação. E a legislação é uma coisa, mas não é uma bola mágica. Aquilo que nós tentamos fazer é ter uma abordagem global da sociedade e dos governos, à qual também se referiu o Sr. Vice-Presidente, e cooperar com as instituições, com os parlamentos nacionais, com as organizações que verificam os factos, com as organizações da imprensa, não só para monitorizar, para saber o que é que está a acontecer, para termos uma maior consciencialização, trabalhando como, por exemplo, em França, eles têm Viginum, para saber como reagir melhor com uma melhor comunicação estratégica, com a melhor comunicação daquilo que, de facto, está a ser debatido no Parlamento. E, por vezes, também com informações claras de resposta, mas a trabalhar muito sobre a prevenção. E foi dito também pelo Vice-Presidente que a literacia é fundamental. E no Parlamento Europeu nós desenvolvemos formação para os membros, com manuais próprios, ou seja, instrumentos que podem ser utilizados diretamente pelos deputados quando são tomados como alvo. Nós também tentamos trabalhar para apoiar a imprensa e tentamos apoiar a sociedade civil, porque o Parlamento tem 2 milhões de visitantes por ano, aproximadamente, no centro e todas as suas agências. Portanto, temos imensas oportunidades para poder falar com os estudantes, os professores, a sociedade civil, com os criadores de conteúdos, para que eles percebam que a democracia não é um dado adquirido, que há uma informação, há um espaço informativo que tem que ser salvaguardado. Eles recebem brochuras com pistas, com informações, temos vídeos que explicam as técnicas de informação, temos até um jogo que se pode jogar. O nome disse oradora, que tem a ver com as táticas que os oradores, que é utilizado para falsificar as eleições. E isto é um jogo muito específico. E nós estamos também a ter exposições e seminários sobre este tópico. E eu aguardo com expectativa o debate. Vou parar aqui. Gostaria de citar o relator que foi preparado, que defender a democracia é uma estratégia de longo prazo e tem que ser apoiado pela vontade política, mas também por recursos apropriados e a crença que todos nós temos, que temos que partilhar a responsabilidade e que iremos sempre encontrar no Parlamento Europeu um parceiro confiável para trabalhar na defesa da democracia. Muito obrigada.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Collard, for all of the clarity in your presentation, telling us how the European Parliament identifies the problem and how it analyzes and also tries to combat the consequences of the problem. So thank you so much for your input. Should we start immediately with the discussion or should we listen to the next speakers? What do you say? And hold the discussion in the end? Very well, in the end. And then I will give the floor to Inês Sousa Guedes, who came from Porto, a bit closer than Brussels. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Vice President, Secretary General, Moderator, dear speakers, it is my pleasure to be here today and on behalf of the Faculty of Law of the Porto University. It is an honor to be here today. I will be focusing on the explanatory factors of disinformation and exposure to it. On the February 17th, 2025, when we were saying goodbye to Jorge Pinto Costa, former president of Porto Football Club, Lisbon had an earthquake almost simultaneously, very rapidly, and mainly through Facebook and WhatsApp. Head titles of a Comercio newspaper spread, saying the day I am buried, Porto will cry, but Lisbon will feel a tremor. So it almost sounded like a premonition, but it was taken as all the truth, but it was fake. The titles did not exist. The first page of this newspaper did not exist. It had been manipulated. This is one example where disinformation gained advantage. It included convincing information so that it spread very rapidly without being verified. In addition to the speed at which it circulated, it is also very important because it happened in the daily flows of our communications, which accounts for about 90 meters of scroll, more or less the height of the Statue of Liberty. It has also been shown that fake news are 70% more likely of being shared than truthful news and take less time to reach crowds much than true news. And why all of this is so important and why are we gathered here today? Well, disinformation produces real effects, namely on democracy, as was mentioned here, because it enhances polarization, it mines confidence, trust in organizations, but also in public health. It reduces trust in authorities, in health recommendations, and in situations of crisis, it can increase risk behavior like a refusal to be vaccinated. In my area of interest, crime, it can contribute to increasing hostility against certain groups and aggravate certain conflicts, like, for example, recently happened in the UK. But the question is, does everybody who share fake news do so intentionally? We must distinguish here between disinformation, which is fake, false contents, and which is shared with the intention to deceive, and misinformation, which is false information as well, but there is no intention to deceive or harm people or institutions. There is also a technique that is used in disinformation, which is malinformation, in other words, real content, but decontextualized. In other words, coming up with the intention to deceive people or institutions. So having said this, and irrespective of the intention, the following question comes up. Why do we believe in fake news? Why are we so vulnerable to it? Why can we not distinguish between true and fake news? And this brings me to heuristics of credibility. For example, if we look at the first page of a newspaper that is well known and it looks familiar and we believe it, we find it credible. But also because news and sentences that are repeated even without evidence become familiar to us. Third aspect that is extremely important is confirmation bias. We interpret information that we receive based on our own experience, on our own life references. So when a story, for example, like the one I told in the beginning, fits into my beliefs, in other words, for example, my own public beliefs, then we believe it more. Also, false, fake news often trigger emotions like fear and shock, and when they do so, they become more believable. And then there is excess of confidence and trust. Authors have calculated 70% of people underestimate their capacity to distinguish between fake news and false. And those who are overconfident are those who make the most mistakes. And why do we share fake news? Recent studies have produced very important conclusions. We can share fake news for fun because we want to trigger reactions, but the truth is that not many people share most fake news. We have here a recent example. Only a small share of the population share fake news. Another interesting fact, accidental or non-intentional sharing of information is much more common than deliberate sharing with the intent of deceiving. Another interesting data is that most people do not read the news and do not open the news before sharing it. They share it only after reading the title or looking at a picture, and immediately they feel the urge of sharing it without even having read the news before. So this makes us think, what explains the sharing of fake news might not be the same as what explains our vulnerability to fake news. And this is where our project Fact Check comes in. It is a project that is aimed at understanding the factors underlying our vulnerability to and will to disseminate fake news. This is an empirical study with a representative sample with this aim in mind. Now, there are other initiatives that did occur, but this is a first study with a representative sample that tries to answer this question. It was the study was funded by La Caixa Foundation. The sample is 1,500 people, and the results should be available in approximately 2 months. The research team is multidisciplinary, and Gustavo Sampaio is the leader of the group. Our study involves two large phases. First, to choose news pieces of news that people would evaluate as true or fake, and then to select a number of variables. So we organized two focus groups with journalists to validate our stimulus, to try to identify the categories, but also the most suitable format of our study, which was this one that you can see in the picture, because it is the one that is most used in our social media. So I have brought to you similar news that we are going to use of domestic politics, on crime, immigration, and other social topics, and health issues and trivial topics. Some of these are fake, others are true, and we are going to ask people what is the probability of their sharing these news, and what is the credibility that they award to them. To conclude, what is the advantage of this project, and to what extent is it important? So, we will first try to answer the question, why people are so vulnerable to fake news and willing to disseminate fake news. And the results will allow us to, or help support the development of public policies in the fight against disinformation. We will be able to answer questions like the level of confidence and trust of people in the parliament, in our security services, in journalists, and understand how these institutions are very important in the dissemination of fake news, and very importantly, may structural factors like economic insecurity of people have people trust less institutions and thus make them more vulnerable to such news. We know that knowledge is power, and this is the name that we have given to our project. And through serious, strict, scientific, rigorous knowledge, we want to produce sound information that will support public policies. And our intention is to fight against disinformation through science. And we hope in the near future to be able to present the results of the project. Thank you very much to you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Inês. It's very nice to see that the Portuguese Academy is looking at these issues, because knowledge can only be obtained through scientific research. And so we do hope that the outcome can have practical applications, and we will eagerly see the outcome of your project, which is so interesting. Now we will listen to the journalists. And I'll give the floor to Luisa Medeiros. I'm sorry, Antonio, I'm unable to work with this. So very good morning to you all. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure and an honor, because disinformation, as we know and as was said here, is indeed a serious problem of our societies, and it is perhaps the biggest threat to our societies in terms of democracy. As a journalist, I will not repeat the issues of disinformation, which was already explained so well. Inês explained what the main concepts were. I myself was part of a focus group that led to this, and I will tell you, it's really, really difficult, even for a more or less experienced person who believes that person is able to distinguish free from real information from fake news. It's really, really difficult. But anyway, I do want to speak about journalism and how they face up to fake news and the responsibility we face. We are journalists. We are the first targets to be brought down, and we also the first line of defense in this war. And I do believe that journalists try to find truth. They seek truth. And truth today has been replaced by virality. And it doesn't matter if it's true or false or so-so. What is important is that there will be clicks, that it will be disseminated, and this is extremely dangerous for our society. The truth is that journalists have the duty to seek truth. Information disorder is a brilliant concept. Inês explained this, because this is what happens today. Can you all read? But I'm not going to explain the phenomenon of disinformation, misinformation, and the impact that it has on speed, as Inês explained so well. But this entails a very big challenge for journalists, because we are the ones who are at stake. So people have to believe in something. If journalists, who are the ones who in principle should have their professional activity, means that they have to follow ethical rules, they have to fact check and be transparent. Transparency is of the essence, and increasingly the issue of journalism in journalism is more and more practiced by large newspapers, and the social consequences, as Ines explained, exist. But I would just like to say that there's something that Obama said, which is really interesting, that I'm sure you know, which is, we all have the right to our opinions, but not to our own facts. We're entitled to our opinions, but not to our own facts. And he quoted when a person said, this is a podium, and the other person says, it's an elephant. This, you know, you can't cooperate. And this is happening more and more. The problem is that debate in our modern societies has evolved from divergence of opinions, which is healthy and crucial, to a debate on reality itself. And that is what is corroding our social life. Fact-checking is the first line of defense. And I would say that this is a discipline. Fact-checking is the core business of a journalist who knows that he or she has to check to go to the source. Hear different voices, like we in Lusa, we say that you have to hear at least three voices on a given fact, or two at the most. But you have at least. But you have to have adversarial debate. This has evolved because in order to do fact-checking, which is the core business of the journalist, but it's more than that, because it involves competencies, digital competencies, and the use of tools, which are almost a specialty in itself, and not always fact-checkers are journalists. In some countries, they are not even journalists, because journalism has a very bad press, and there are studies that demonstrate this. A fact checker can be a journalist or not, but both check information. Social platforms. Ines talked about this data, social media. We live in bubbles. We are more susceptible to believe in fake news. There's a combination of human factors and algorithms which lead us to the situation. But the point is, for journalists today, the social platforms are of the essence, and for journalism in general, for the media in general. The platforms are vectors of disinformation, but they are also crucial for information. It's no use trying to hide the fact, and that is why journalists have to monitor disinformation and communicate accurately in a competitive environment, in the competitive environment of disinformation. This is because I would like to show you, this is a survey, a poll conducted by the European Parliament, a poll on social media to give you the scale of the phenomenon in Portugal and the European Union. Portugal, as you see, exposure to disinformation. Portugal, the various bars, exceeds the European, more than the European average. It considers itself to be exposed to misinformation, to disinformation, which is good. It doesn't mean that there is more disinformation in Portugal. It means that indeed the Portuguese are more aware of disinformation. And that's interesting, and it's very positive and even surprising. This is a recent phenomenon. a worrying phenomenon for journalism, and it can also be an outlet for fact-checking in journalism. The European average follows influencers in order to get information. They follow one influencer. In the European Union, it's 37%. In Portugal, it's 43%. So there is a divergence here. And I would like to quote this data, which is the lesser the age, the younger you are, the more prevalence you have, the more you will follow influences. Between 15 and 24 years of age in Portugal, 84% follows influences of our young people in order to get information. 84%. The European Union average is 74%, so it's not that far away. Between 25 and 30, in Portugal, you have 67%, in the European Union, 61%, and then it, starting at 55, only 21% follow influencers. In the European Union, it's 14%. These are the formats that people prefer in the social media. People prefer short texts, 1 to 2 minutes, videos, 1 to 5 minutes, sorry, and videos lasting less than a minute. So now we go on to the core business. Journalism is based on the exercise of freedom of speech. But, as I said before, this is an activity that is based on ethical rules that are very rigorous, and that distinguishes it from other forms of expression. Everybody's free to give their opinions and make any comments or what have you, but journalists do not have this freedom. That is, they also have this, but in line with ethical rules. So this is what distinguishes journalists. Ethics, that's our deontology. And quite often, rigor, independence, justice, honesty, protection of confidentiality of the sources are principles of our profession, as well as separating opinions from news. That's crucial for a journalist. I'm not speaking about commentators. For a journalist, they should separate facts from news, because otherwise we'll all be discussing opinions on news and not the news as such. And this already happens. We see this on a daily basis, and this is very serious, and this contributes to the disaccreditation of journalists. And the speed of news, the desire to be the first ones to broadcast the news because you have the clicks and publicity, this cannot be a replacement for rigor. We live this problem every single day, and all the more so in Lusa, because it's our responsibility to provide reliable information. And this for a while, and sometimes this takes a while. Like if you want to report somebody's death, you have to have a credible source, or any other event. Sometimes we take a little longer because we are checking the facts. Transparency. This is really interesting, because to explain the origin of information and sources strengthens the trust of the public in professional journalism. This is not new, but it's practiced in a different way. The New York Times, in the large news features or the large investigations, they do a sort of making of the news feature. That is, as they tell the story of what is happening in some investigative journalism, they explain how they got there, who they heard, and this is really crucial for the public in order to regain trust of the public. Well, how should journalists react? Well, this is the summary, basically, that you see here on the board. You have to fact check transparency of the editing rules to set the context of the information. And as our vice president said, journalists can also collaborate in literacy, because journalists are able to write news and draft articles, so they can teach the public with a little how to teach people to check the news, to ask the right questions, which are very simple, in order to find a lie, to detect a lie. Let's go forward, says the speaker. So challenges of current journalism algorithms shape access to information. We know that they give priority to content that evoke emotion and can distort perception. What is really complicated nowadays, and a lot of people speak about our deficit, our democratic deficit, and this happens with AI. We are no longer the ones who choose our news. In the past, you'd buy the newspaper you wanted, or you'd switch the channel you wanted to, whereas today, that's not so. When we see news on the internet and the social media, which is a very common, the algorithm will make this choice for us. It has become the editor, and so it doesn't tell you. It shows you what we want to see or hear, what the algorithm thinks we want to read or see or read, but not necessarily the actual truth. And this is so serious. Like for example, we see Google, where everybody is searching, like you Google things up. Recently, Google has introduced, as you know, a small note made by AI. And in the past, Google worked as aggregators of information. You'd ask a question, and it would send us to a newspaper article or something. But now it doesn't. AI makes a summary of this information. A lot of people don't go beyond that. Probably all of us, that's how it works. Our life is this. And this is really serious also for the business and sustainability of media, because if platforms in the past were able to guide the traffic to these media outlets so that they could be sustainable financially, because there's no free journalism unless you have a media company that is sustainable, that's not possible. What is happening today is that there is a loss of traffic last year, 2025, one-third of this traffic that was addressed to traditional media outlets, only in Google alone, it fell by one-third. And the forecasts for this year show that it's going to fall by even more. And this puts huge challenges to the sustainability of media, and therefore the loss of free journalism, the incapacity to provide rigorous news. Then we also know that there was the era of gatekeepers in the past, like the journalists were the gatekeepers of public information. Today, anybody can do this badly or rightly or wrongly, and this is sometimes good, because we have the citizen journalists, but there's also the journalists of the community, where journalism gives a voice to the community, and they can only do this if there is a concrete contribution of the community, of actual people. So this has a good side and a downside. It's not good or bad, it's different, and we have to adapt to new realities. Today, the future of journalism is an ongoing struggle, like everything else in life. We have to adapt, otherwise we will die. And journalism needs to reinvent formats, live formats. That's the big trend nowadays, and a revolution for the media, because for newspapers to write or to have audios, it's a continuity. But to do videos, that's something else. To have news in videos, that's a new ball game. And to adapt to digital audiences, and have credibility as the core value. And I would like to, on videos, to ask you to think about influences that we follow. It can be a way forward for journalism, if you want. I'm sorry for treating you, for calling you out like this instead of saying distinguished audience. So anyway, you do follow journalists for sure, or politicians or what have you in the social media or influencers in general. And this is practiced today in Portugal, but why not use them? Why not? If they... Journalists can also be influencers. We already have them in Portugal. This can be so profitable that the journalist will leave the company, but that's a risk. Anyway, this is all, this places us in a position where how can we react to this? How can we reconnect to the public? You have to have the right strategies. One last point. Fact-checking and fact-checkers. Fact-checkers, there was a big boom in fact-checkers in the first, in 2016 with the first election of Trump and with Brexit, which raised many questions as regards the involvement of Russia in the American elections and other sources. And in Brexit, we knew how this panned out after the Cambridge Analytical scandal. So the platforms themselves financed fact-checking. And this was good, because for a fact-checker, he could act in the same place, in the same moment when this information was occurring. And there were major funds. And this led to this boom. They financed over half of their activity, but this was finished with the second election of Trump. We know that Meta, Zuckerberg said, this is over, we will no longer finance this, and this raises a huge problem for a profession which is crucial for our democracy today, which is fact-checking. How do you live? How do you reconnect? How can this be? How can you live and be funded to do this crucial activity for our democracy? I think that we all have to think about this. And this is the House of Democracy, this Portuguese Parliament in Portugal, where the politicians also legislate. We should really think about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Luisa. And indeed, press needs to be very strong in the battle against disinformation, and the sustainability of the system is crucial. As you said, if companies are not sustainable, this whole system becomes much weaker and more permeable. And it doesn't help for journalists to be effective. We will now give the floor to José Pacheco Pereira. Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I am going to show a PowerPoint which I've had used in other occasions to highlight some images and sentences that are not very well known. Now, this is a quotation from the Bible that says that God fulminates liars. And fortunately, God no longer has these practices. Now, these are the basis of disinformation, lies. Jesuits use this, omission, lies, and suggestion of falsehoods. And this is how information was manipulated. These are the foundations. Now, nothing of this, none of this is new. The technological upgrade in these areas is what is new. the Second World War triggered this, and I'll give you an example. This is a magazine of British propaganda. Neptune was the newspaper, the magazine of the British Navy. Now, this is fake news in the current meaning of the word. So the cover does not allow us to establish the content. The layout looks like the real Neptune newspaper, and then there is the contents, which was fake, about a sunken ship. This is also from a German newspaper. So we are going to have an exhibition on propaganda of the Second World War. Comic strips, graphics, posters were very much used. These are posters of the German of wars that they lost, but they are presented here as won wars, and comic strips. If you read Second World War German propaganda, and if you do not know the context in which it was produced, it looks like an attack against British colonialism, imperialism, and the defense of their society. And this is very much part of propaganda in the Second World War. Here, an attack on Churchill. It looks like Churchill is threatening people and British security forces when, as the picture has been cut in half, and when we look at the full picture, we see workers in a Nazi manifestation. The use of postcards as well, and caricatures in postcards, these were all techniques used by several countries, Italian as well. All of this has been studied, and very interestingly, we also use this in our colonial war times. A lot of the propaganda during the colonial wars, we use these methods. These posters, for example, we would find in Angola and in Mozambique, which expresses not only the racial nature of our colonialism, but also questioning the role of our soldiers. For example, this one is propaganda of the Portuguese army in Mozambique against Frelimo. And the message is always the same. If you fight, you will be able to eat, you'll have a girlfriend, a partner, etc. Most of these men and women were executed after the independence, but this is an example of propaganda by the municipality of Lisbon, saying thank you to you, Lisbon. Those of you who, or when we look at these posters, we think that the Pope is thanking Lisbon, but the fact it's the opposite. It's Lisbon thanking the Pope. Suggestio falsi is very much present here and very much used by us, inclusively in manipulating language. For example, when we speak of cuts in the beginning, in the following day we speak of savings instead of cuts. Nowadays, many techniques, propaganda techniques, came from communication agencies that teach political parties how to use these techniques that I showed in the beginning, like suggest your falsies. I would like to show this film. So what you're about to see is a very short film about a disinformation operation of which I was a target. And one of the reasons I'm showing this film is because it was produced together with a large amount of fake news by someone who at the time was a teacher of the School of Law, and I sued him. I sued him precisely because he was a teacher at the Faculty of Law, assistant professor. And the thesis of the film was the following. Pacheco Pereira is an agent of Iran, and this was well before the current conflicts. And he flies in luxury to Tehran on several occasions, and there is a sequence of news that was placed in the sites of Vox, for example, and some sites reproduced it. And this sequence of news, and all of which is fake, I never went to Tehran. Unfortunately, I am sad that, and now I cannot go. And when he lost in court and he had to pay compensation to me, which was enough for a first-class ticket to Tehran. And this is how it must work. Freedom of information, in my view, goes much beyond the American concept of freedom of speech. But this is invented news, and it has nothing to do with freedom of speech. This gentleman created the story about flights to Iran, parties in the embassy of Tehran, and then he built stories. For example, I listened to conversations in Iran that I had never had. At the time, I had a peritonitis, and I lost a lot of weight. And he said, I lost weight not because I because I was sick, but rather because I had fallen in love and was not correspondent. And the news continued inclusively that I was an observer. So a sequence of systematic information produced as mechanism of fake news, of which this film is an example. It's quite an old film produced by a monarchical association, and it has sound, and it's important that we listen to the sound, says the speaker. The technological upgrade of disinformation has not reached the parliament, says the gentleman. This is what we want to see, the video. With sound, please. It's worth waiting for because it's an excellent example of disinformation. And this is quite superficial, I should say. Should I click the button? So this is news about Pacheco Pereira and how he has connections with the Iran, and the Iranian regime has seen Pacheco Pereira as a good person and a good channel for interference in politics in Portugal, and identifying the different connections with different personalities in Portugal, like Marcos Mendes, who has a law firm, And they're giving different facts. Pacheco Pereira is a friend of Lula da Silva, who, from whom he received a luxury apartment and has received support from IRA. Intelligence services of Iran have contributed to his historical archive. The port of Lisbon is partly controlled by Yilport, a Turkish company with interests in Iran and in Lula. At the doors of Lisbon, Pacheco Pereira in 2011 flew to Iran with a diplomatic passport, departing from Lisbon to Paris. In Paris, he caught a new flight to Qatar and from there to Iran, to where he went to negotiate new opportunities of cooperation between the two countries. Pacheco Pereira is a very popular figure in Tunisia and with whom and who had connections to Yasser Arafat. In times in the past, he supported the election of Luis Marcos Mendes. Rafael Moura, in the past, agreed with Pacheco Pereira to never speak about his investigation against the company Ingor. Rafael Moura influenced Luis Marcos Mendes to consort with the member of the parliament, Mariana Mortágua, to be kind in our investigation by the parliament to the Novo Bank. Furthermore, Pacheco Pereira and Marcos Mendes asked José María Richiade to sustain their connections to Iran. So this is an example of quite a primitive, relatively primitive news. But I wish to call your attention to the following. In the fight against disinformation, it is necessary to distinguish between freedom of speech and, from our perspective, it is a very broad definition, rather in the tradition, the American tradition, and distinguish that from disinformation. And that must be taken to court. And Portuguese courts must realize that they must punish everything that is invention and lies and freedom of speech, distinguish it from freedom of speech. And this is what I did. The gentleman who produced this film had to apologize publicly, must pay compensation to me, which he has not yet paid, must declare that all of this was lied, and this has a educational effect. And law must punish things like these, which are inventions, simply put. Nowadays, it would be more sophisticated, certainly. In our archive, we have large amounts of things like these, lies, fake omissions of truth. And this is our daily bread. In advertising, in political propaganda, in a lot of news production, it is very easy to identify these mechanisms that then become viral, even in journalism. For example, I am very critical about journalists quoting information from social media. They normally quote only 100 or 90 at the maximum and mostly well-known people. And as a result of that, they do not carry out the necessary editing that would be necessary to exclude fake news. As you know, the origin of this was Desinformatia. And this was deliberately used by information services, and they use it to manipulate elections, to attack people and to defend people. And this means that what we are creating is a generation, especially in schools, of easily people that can be easily manipulated. Democracy and demagogy are twins, but they are differentiated by one thing. Democracy has procedures. This is why we don't only have elections to have democracy. We need the primacy of law and democratic procedures as well. People often say, yes, he was elected. Okay, he was elected, but he does not comply with the law. Hitler was also elected, but he never abided by the law. So the primacy of the law, checking of electoral procedures, sovereign will as well and popular will as well is important. And truth nowadays must be aggressive. I know that aggressive doesn't sound well, but truth nowadays must be aggressive. So when somebody says a lie in front of us, we must say, you are lying. If we have the cameras recording us, and if this is broadcasted indirect, it will have an enormous power. So lie when is confronted directly, and when it is broadcasted, when somebody confronts the liar, that has enormous communicational power. And this is one way of making lies, which nowadays have very long legs. Technologies have given lie long legs, and now we need to fight against this by confronting liars directly, face to face. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sepeshik Pereira.
Recentering the issue of information in historical terms, we can only prepare the future if you know the past. Otherwise, it's impossible. And also for the concerns that you explained so well. So we listen to how the European Parliament acts on these matters. Science is being produced in order to combat misinformation. The role of journalists, the historical outlook, and the concerns raised by Pacheco Pereira. So now we can talk about these topics, and I'd like to see if somebody wants to come in on this so we can have a debate. Some people are raising their hands. Is there a roving mic, Marlene? I apologize because I can't really see because I'm blinded by the light. So I can't really see you, but I'll ask people to identify themselves, to introduce themselves, and please be as objective as you possibly can, because we've already heard the speeches, so now we would like to have shorter speeches. So, Zé Magalhães, you have the microphone. Congratulations for this initiative. Pacheco Pereira, at a given moment, said that we should have an aggressive or active stance and use the courts to combat disinformation. This is possible in the Portuguese, under the Portuguese legislative system, but I don't think we would be complete if we didn't speak about the landmark act in the Portuguese Parliament, which was the approval on the 27th of February after a lengthy debate. A law was approved to put in practice the directive on digital services. If this law is enacted, it will change the way in which disinformation can be combated using legal instruments, namely the use of ANACOM, ERC, and the National Data Protection Committee in view of specific cases, and it even sets up the signposts of the breach of law, which will communicate to these authorities cases of disinformation. And disinformation is not a crime. It can be or cannot be, or it may be in some cases and not in others. If it is a crime, then the police has to be notified. So this new rule, whose application will face challenges, and which has great opponents, namely the cyber anarchists, and we do have cyber anarchists in high positions. This law has to be, first of all, known, then it has to be applied, and it's not going to be easy to apply this, but without this fact-checking and all of that, doesn't have any real clout. So thank you so much for being able to come in on this. Thank you. I'm sorry that I couldn't call you up by your name because I'm blinded by the light, but I'm really happy that you're here and the law has to be enacted in order to be able to make it really become effective as the Parliament wants it to be. Does anybody else wish to speak, come in on any other points? I'm José Cordeiro. I also work in this on these issues, and Portugal, fortunately, sometimes things don't come in at first. What can we learn from other countries where these phenomena are very corrosive? We know that there will be certain measures as citizens. We have to follow certain measures, or what measures can we take in order to prevent the widespread use of these practices? Maria Santos, some of the disinformation comes from the states, like the war of Iraq. Supposedly there were mass destruction weapons. In terms of the digital regulations and in view of the trend of using software to regulate digital platforms, given that they are agencies that are financed by the states themselves to control disinformation, how can we ensure the freedom of speech? Thank you. Very well. We will now hear our guests. Who wants to come in first? Thank you so much for your questions. As a scientist, trying to build scientific knowledge, perhaps I could give you some insights on what we've thought about, namely in terms of prevention and intervention of disinformation. But I would even go as far as say misinformation, because as I stated, most people who share disinformation, false news, they are not aware that this is a fake news, that these are fake news. And this is a problem which has to do with what was said about media literacy and digital literacy, but especially media literacy. I know that Portugal is rolling out, even in school curricula, media literacy, and this is a crucial step. But I would say that there are strategies that have been assessed outside Portugal, not so much in Portugal, which have to do with on the basis of the theory of inoculation and debunking and pre-bunking. What does this mean? It means on the one hand that one of two things. You show people fake news, and then you have a debate explaining that these news are fake and why are they fake, and you teach people to distinguish between fake. This is working at preventive level, which is more efficient, and debunking has to do with the later stage, which is what we're going to do in the questionnaire, which is at the end of the questionnaire, people will access a link where they will see which news were false and which ones were true, and this is the later stage. And why is this so important? Because if we expose people to news, they will be exposed to different fake news. And this is an important step. In science, we will explain to people that the news were fake. So these activities have been efficient. in other countries. And I would like to draw your attention that we need, in Portugal, we have to have these interventions and assess them. And that is why, speaking in terms of scientific knowledge, if we implement practices of media literacy and we are unable to assess with a real experimental protocol, we won't be able to know whether this worked. So together with any intervention for misinformation or disinformation, you have to have a later rigorous and objective evaluation. I'm not excluding, of course, legal issues, the importance of building, of having real journalism. I'm not setting these actions aside. I'm focusing on how can scientific knowledge be improved by raising people's awareness about these fake news. We said that it was necessary to prevent. Some said that fake news come at the highest level, and they are then conveyed by state actors, as happened with the mass destruction weapons in Iraq. What can be the role of journalists to help in this prevention and combating this? That's our daily task as journalists. It's an ongoing process. This process of deconstructing lie is not only to help people. Illiteracy, media literacy taught to children is not sufficient. This is something that is happening, that is already being conducted, and some studies show that our young people are very skeptical. They're very skeptical. So we have to be careful in order to create a society of skeptics where people no longer believe in anything. I don't think it's, which is worse, like believing fake news or not believing in anything at all. On journalists and news and how things change, I always remember a project that was carried out by a number of journalists funded by Gulbenkian Foundation, where the point was to do media literacy with young people, especially those in less favored areas, living in less favored areas. And it was like three or four journalists who would bring with them a number of newspapers, first pages, in order to cover pages, in order to work with the young people. And the first difficulty, to see if they believed in the headlines, if they knew what was being said, what was being stated, what the headlines said. And the first problem that we found was that none of them knew what that was. They had no idea what these newspapers were. They had never seen them, various Portuguese newspapers. And so this is at the outset the problem. And this also raises other problems, which is as regards politicians. There's a study that was conducted by the Navarro University. Lusa belongs to a joint venture in Iberia called Identifier that studies disinformation in the Iberian Peninsula. The leader of this joint venture is Professor Ramon Salaveria. And they published recently a study on the lies of politicians, which, in actual fact, what we've seen over the past few years, especially when elections come around, is overwhelming. Increasingly, politicians go from misinformation to disinformation, tout court. And this raises many problems. That is why media literacy is not sufficient. Fact-checking is required. You have to really confront people. And as Pacheco Pereira said, say what that person is saying is a lie.
And you need to be courageous to do this. And you need to be courageous for journalists who, and for their companies, besides having to take the step, they then face attacks and harassment, which can be virulent. There are cases where fact checkers, journalists who do this kind of work or who do normal news features, which are not pure fact checking, are harassed, and in even including death threats, namely in Spain, for example. There was a case where this fact checker has a prize on her head. She almost needs security because she denounces lies in television of politicians, which is what is really relevant. In order to survive, fact checkers had to be careful with their own lives. They are doing fact-checking of things that are really important for the citizens, like fraud. And we've all been the victims of these attempts of fraud using mobile phones, like fake messages from your children asking for money. So this is really important in terms of public service, but it leaves aside the other side, which is very important, which is the political level of disinformation, and you have to be really careful. Before giving the floor to Pacheco Pereira, we used to say that politicians used to say, I don't mind bad press as long as they talk about me in order to become notorious. But nowadays, platforms are used, and TikToks, to disseminate what I'm going to say. If it's true or not doesn't really matter. What matters is the reach. It's curious, if you allow me, that here in the Portuguese Parliament there is a tradition of programs with young people. The Youth Parliament covers 1,300 schools, and the MPs go to get in touch with young people. We have lots of students visiting our parliament, and then we see that 84% follow influencers. And it seems that we should do a lot more in terms of prevention. Can't you help us a little bit? The President of the Republic should not receive influencers as if they were. Go straight to the point. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the president received influences, and I criticize him for this. This is a far larger problem than the social media. It has to do with the way in which we build our societies. Our society is creating, not only in Portugal, a huge increase of ignorance, of illiteracy in general. When you go to a school and people ask me to speak about financial literacy, I find it difficult to do that for teenagers who, the first time, they don't have any money. Secondly, they will steal what they have, and then they gamble with the money they have. So the discussion on financial literacy is in a context where people are feeling lonely, where there is more exclusion, where social relations, be it a neighborhood or friendship, is more remote. We are building a very cruel society, and this society enables these phenomena to be upgraded. There's nothing more lonely than to have somebody hanging onto the iPad or computer at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's a true symbol of solitude, of loneliness, replacing friendships with likes. The thing that happened in the school in southern Portugal is an example, an autistic child was being beaten up by a colleague, and ten colleagues were filming this, and nobody helped him. And this is the portrait of our society. It's the portrait of the cruelty and solitude and loneliness and exclusion and poverty in our society, because they are very significant social factors to which both the state and the school are not being able to face. School, which was a phenomenon to change this, has to change the way in which it understands its relation
from kindergarten with people, because this cannot be taught in academic terms only or as if it was a pure literacy. When people talk about literacy, I always take a step back, because basic literacy, like, I don't believe there's a single student, except for exceptions, of course, the wealthier people who have books. People are supposed to read the Maias, which is a Portuguese novel. I really doubt that they read the Maias. Most of the vocabulary is not something they would understand. George Orwell, in 1984, explained that one of the things that Big Brothers did was every year he would decrease the number of words being used, and this decrease in vocabulary is happening today in posts and TikTok, where the number of words that circulate is growing smaller by the day, so the capacity to express yourself is diminishing, and the capacity to be manipulated is consequently increasing. A lot of the Portuguese literature cannot be read unless you know the Bible, the translation. I'm an atheist, so, you know, it's nothing religious, but the biblical tradition is a structuring element of our culture. And when I go to schools, and I go a lot to schools, and I ask, like, I ask two or three questions. One of them is, who is Adam and Eve? And you think they know, only the evangelical students know who Adam and Eve is, most of them. They know it's the first people, but they have no idea. So the loss of this cultural identity means that they can't understand literature. The other big strand is the Greco-Latin tradition. Who's Achilles? How can you read Lysiades if you don't know who Achilles was? The Lysitan Achilles, as it happens, was a relative of mine by chance. We have to quote Pro Domus Suo. So the same thing happens on old stories, classical stories, on hell, on muses. And all of this is a tradition that was part of secondary school. We have in ephemera a lot of old books. Of course, democratization of learning has really changed the social context of school, so you can't look to the past as if it was something golden. But there's a number of things which enabled a minimum culture, which was then reflected in the lack of media literacy or the lack of literacy to cour in all fields, where people find it more difficult to express themselves, to have rational arguments. But this also happens in Parliament. When I was in the Parliament, I used to say that if I stumbled at the entrance of the plenary and if the cameras were on, I would always appear in the news that night. They were always looking for an excuse to make me appear in the news. And the same happens with building the news services, the news in television, which still play a major role in building public opinion, although adults more and more become like children. Like, people think you're a teenager until you're 38. It means it's unacceptable, because that makes it's dumbing down the adults. Most of the French revolutionaries, when their heads were cut off, they were 20-something years old, so like Saint-Just. So society, adults are being transformed into children, and children are also made even more into children, because they can't grow up and face up to the problems which they had to face when they became adults. And at 17 or 18, people could go to the army, and people could vote. Now we are building a society of very, very lonely people, very selfish people, very aggressive people in political and ideological confrontation, because that's what you have. Aggressiveness is a very empathic mechanism. When I said that you have to face truth with truth, it works. Who raised problems to Trump in the United States? The Anglican pastor defending the immigrants in the first row of Congress, and this really had an impact. Or journalists in the press conferences, although they are being threatened and insulted, like being called Miss Piggy. I mean, absolutely abnormal things are happening, like a man who appears on the official site of the White House as a Superman and sitting behind a map where Canada is painted with American colors and Greenland, I mean, this is beyond the pale. This should make Europeans having a different attitude than trying to sort of lick his boots. So we should normalize all these things. A lot of absolutely abnormal things are happening. If we went back 10 years, a man like this would be interned. And it's not only because of that, because this pathological narcissism, he would be interned. He would be in a psychiatric hospital. But this is tending to become normalized, and then it's replicated elsewhere. So our combat on disinformation cannot stay at that level alone. It has to be at the level of society, technological upgrades, where people are really dazzled by this politician, especially. You have to think that you can read on a screen in a mobile phone. We have an award in ephemera, which is if you were able to read War and Peace of Tolstoy on your mobile phone, and nobody ever ran for this, because it's impossible. Also, we are creating exclusions that are invisible, that are not covered by the press. For example, people who cannot see well, do not have the possibility, if they use screens, of having the same access to information than other people. Who speaks about this? Like during the Troika, who said that the first thing that broke down were the lifts, and all the people couldn't climb the stairs? There's a lot of things like this. Well, I could go on forever. Well, we know we are.
Delphine, we have here several situations. We have listened to José Magalhães, who reminded us that the Portuguese Parliament discussed recently law on this matter. We also have learned about the need to work on prevention together with the younger or the less younger and prepare them for this phenomena, the role of journalists, and the absolute need for them to play a role here in this struggle. Pacheco Pereira spoke about the importance of everyone fighting against some of this phenomenon that is a threat to democracy and citizenship. So I'd like to hear you about how the European Parliament is addressing all of this. Can we expect laws, European laws, where all of this interconnects so that we have a common front, European common front, against these phenomena, not only against laws or economic wars, but how can we all, as Europe, as a unit, coordinate ourselves to be more efficient in this struggle?
A senhora agradece aos intérpretes. Efetivamente, tem razão. Toda esta abordagem da sociedade é muito importante e está presente ao nível europeu. Existe uma nova iniciativa da Comissão que suporta todas as iniciativas individuais que se desenrolaram nos últimos 7 anos. Portanto, está um grande enfoque na resiliência europeu, envolvendo não apenas os Estados, mas também a sociedade civil. Um elemento é, sem dúvida, as leis europeias. O que é ilegal online também deve ser ilegal offline, ou vice-versa. A liberdade de expressão é, efetivamente, uma liberdade dos seres humanos e não das máquinas, não dos bots. É a liberdade de discussão, mas não é a liberdade de distribuição, de alcance. E, como dizia, implementação é chave. E o Parlamento Europeu está a insistir na implementação por parte da Comissão. As grandes plataformas não estão a cumprir esta nova lei dos serviços digitais. A IA permite criar imagens de sexo explícito, que é, por exemplo, um tema muito problemático, está a ser investigado. As grandes plataformas que normalmente, ao abrigo da lei europeia, têm que cumprir um código de conduta e não estão a implementar isto. Referiu que têm obrigações e nos primeiros 5, 6 anos comprometeram-se através do fact-checking, mas isto é uma tendência que hoje já não se verifica, todo este apoio está a ser retirado. E temos um novo estudo que efetivamente confirma que estas grandes plataformas estão, tal como a professora dizia, a seguir o caminho e a definição americana de liberdade de expressão e a ignorar a legislação europeia. A proteção dos meios de comunicação também é muito importante. Temos o Media Freedom Act e estamos também a fazer, reforçar todos os esforços de reforço da proteção do jornalismo. Queremos apoiar ao nível europeu os nossos jornalistas, também damos formação aos nossos jornalistas e é muito importante dotá-los de novas ferramentas para que compreendam como é que funciona este novo ecossistema. Também falava de resiliência. Tentamos documentar tudo isto para identificar as melhores práticas nos vários Estados-membros. A Finlândia e os Estados Bálticos desenvolveram ferramentas muito bons. Portanto, temos desenvolvido o tema de inoculação e de resiliência com base nestas ferramentas. E tentamos explicar as táticas utilizadas pelos atores de desinformação. Táticas que temos que exemplificar, por exemplo, jogar com as emoções, tentar silenciar as vozes contrárias. Algo que seja demasiado bom para ser verdade deve ser questionada, por exemplo. É este tipo de informações que tentamos divulgar nas escolas, por exemplo. E trabalhar com os jovens é muito importante. Os jovens já estão muito sensibilizados para estas questões e até duvidem muitas vezes, duvidam muito. As gerações mais antigas é que são mais problemáticas, porque acham que aquilo que estão a ler online foi verificado pelos jornalistas. Portanto, temos de trabalhar muito mais com as gerações mais antigas, ajudá-las a compreender como é que funciona o algoritmo, por exemplo. E tentamos também jogar jogos em que os colocamos, por exemplo, no papel dos maus, para que percebam como é que estas mentes funcionam. Vote for Turtle, por exemplo, é um dos jogos em que, por exemplo, podem jogar o papel de um mau a tentar viciar eleições. Portanto, o Parlamento Europeu tem um papel a desempenhar. E países como Polónia, os países do Báltico, a Finlândia, porque já estiveram nestas circunstâncias, nestas situações há mais tempo, têm uma melhor preparação e podemos aprender com eles, para que possamos generalizar os meios mais eficientes.
Thank you very much. Our four speakers brought to us different outlooks, different perspectives, different views. I would like to also thank our organizers for this conference. This will be the first of many. Thank you very much to all of your team who were bold enough to propose this discussion in this house, in the House of Democracy. Thank you very much. And I give the floor to the Secretary General for the closing speech. Good afternoon to all. President of the Board of the Parliament, your remarks on the light were right on spot. Allow me to start by greeting and thanking the President of the Board, who has always supported us, the Parliament and the staff, in the promotion of public discussion in this House of Democracy. We don't have the Vice President any longer with us, but I thank him as well. And thank you so much to our speakers, who were remarkable, absolutely remarkable. For very long not seen in a conference such thrilling speeches, very clear. And how can I say this? Very objective, without fear. And also, thank you to everyone. Mr. Pacheco Pereira, I apologize because somewhere in my speech I have the word literacy, so I will be pronouncing it, and my apologies. So, you mentioned something which went straight to my heart, is the fact that we should not be afraid of saying this is a lie, because we Portuguese, and this might be very cultural, we are very twisted in and we beat a lot around the bush. We are afraid of confronting people and telling them you are lying, and this is a cultural characteristic. I have also been a victim of this, or rather, I was aware of this in a past life when I studied my master's in Melbourne, in Australia, who very clearly and very confrontationally say, what you're saying is absolutely bollocks. I mean, how can somebody say this to a student? Why do they say this? Well, because they are not afraid to speak the truth, and I think we also must learn with them. And coming to a close of this conference in this House of Democracy, we cannot ignore the symbolic strength of the place where we find this beautiful place. The Parliament is a place of plural debate, of transparency and political accountability. It is antidote, or should be the antidote, against manipulation, against noise and organized lies. So speaking of fake news and disinformation in the Parliament is to affirm that the quality of democracy increasingly depends on the quality of information. This morning, we discussed one of the biggest challenges of our times, the relationship between information, truth, and democracy, and the choice of this topic was not haphazard. It reflects a real concern about the quality of our public space and the soundness of our democratic institutions. And please bring me some water, says the speaker. And this is why we need a assistant. Thank you. Thank you. That's all. Thank you so much. Democracy. It depends on a very simple but demanding assumption. Informed citizens that are capable of forming free decisions. Without that, the democratic process may formally exist but loses substance. We vote, we debate, we decide, but the base on which these decisions are taken becomes weak. So disinformation acts precisely on this. It does not destroy abruptly democracy. Its effect is more subtle. It weakens trust. It confuses the public debate and fragments the perception of reality. It is important that all of us, in groups or individuals, share a minimum of common facts. And I believe the Vice President mentioned this. Without this, the democratic dialogue will become progressively weakened. This is why the fight against disinformation cannot be addressed only as a technological or mediatic problem. It's first and foremost a democratic problem. But we also must avoid simplifications. Disinformation, and this was also mentioned here, is not indeed a new phenomenon. Manipulation of information accompanies the life of public life. And this was mentioned by Pacheco Pereira. What changed was scale, speed, and the sophistication of the instruments. Today, fake or manipulated contents can circulate globally in minutes. Algorithms amplify strong emotions. Digital platforms enable the creation of networks of influence that go beyond borders and escape easily the traditional regulatory mechanisms. And so in face of this reality, we may be tempted to adopt exclusively technological or institutional solutions, regulation, fact-checking. Controlling platforms, controlling of platforms, all play their part. But there is an essential point that no regulation can replace. Critical capacity, the capacity of criticism of citizens. And this is where a dimension which I feel key comes in. Political and democratic literacy, particularly among younger people and all people. And this does not depend only on formal rules. It also depends on a living democratic culture of citizens who understand the functioning of organizations, who know how to distinguish between legitimate criticism and deliberate manipulation. And this is why the Assembly has sought to go out to the people and bring the people to the Assembly. This is something that was created, but that we need to reinforce in order to have more democratic literacy. Nowadays, young people grow in an informational environment that is radically different from the environment that molded generations like mine. Their relationship with information is mediated by social media, by constant flows of contents, quick formats, and often very intense ones. And disinformation takes advantage of this, of contents, of intense emotional contents. And in this context, to teach facts alone is not enough. We need to teach people to think about information, about asking very easy, fundamental questions. Who produced this information? With which objective? What are the sources? And what are the interests at stake? what emotions are these contents trying to strike. To cultivate such questions is to cultivate critical spirit. And that is not an entrance to democracy. It is one of its essential poles. Critical citizenship does not mean cynical citizenship. It does not mean rejecting everything or mistrusting everything. It means rather to assess and to form opinions based on rational criteria and well-informed criteria. And another sip of water, says the speaker. Thank you very much. This is a task that cannot be awarded solely to schools. It involves families, universities, mass media, public institutions, and the public sphere. To defend democracy also implies defending the quality of public debate. And that requires collective commitment to factual truth and to the value of discourse. And allow me to add another very important dimension. Often we talk about disinformation as something that comes from the outside, that is produced by ill-intentioned actors. These such phenomena do exist and are real, but it would be a mistake to ignore that disinformation also prospers in environments where there is frustration, mistrust, and a gap between, distancing between institutions and citizens. When citizens believe that life in the polis is opaque, they are more prone to simplifying narratives. Thus, combating disinformation also involves bringing people closer to institutions, making institutions more transparent, promoting participation, and explaining decisions. A well-understood democracy is also a more resilient democracy. In this conference, we listened to valuable inputs from different perspectives, academic, institutional, historical, and this is an example of what democracy should be, a space of dialogue, of well and plural, well-informed and plural. But a conference does not at all, of course, resolve the issue of disinformation, and is not its intent, but it hopes to reinforce collective conscience of this challenge, because ultimately to defend democracy is not to protect institutions, it's to protect the conditions to ensure that information and a democracy functions. If we manage to guarantee such conditions, democracy will always have the capacity to renovate itself and to rise to new challenges. And I end with a very simple idea. It is better to, the best defense against disinformation is not only technology or only regulation. The best defense is informed citizenship that is democratically engaged, citizenship that values truth, that participates in the public debate, and that understands that democracy is not a given. It is a project that needs to be continuously cultivated. And we leave this place convinced that to fight disinformation is not to limit freedom of speech, it's rather to protect it. And we need to tell young people that critical spirit is essential. And this is the spirit that I hope we take back with us after this conference. Once more, it was very inspirational.
I'm already thinking about a second edition of this topic because it's very rich, very complex and dynamic topic, increasingly so what we see, what we have been seeing since Saturday in the world, happening in the world, makes this topic even more relevant. And it is our responsibility to discuss it. And I'll take this opportunity, and many of you have already heard me say this, and I wish to tell you the fable of the colibri. Imagine a globe representing the Earth. And in the middle, there is an enormous fire, and the colibri. The colibri is a very small, the smallest bird in nature, the hummingbird. In nature, it is extremely small, and it's trying to put an end to the fire with the very little water it can bring in its beak. But somebody tells him, you must realize that you will never be able to end the fire. And the hummingbird says, you're right, but I will do my part. So if we all, each and every one of us, do our part, play our part in the life of the polis. If we are a dynamic, if we raise awareness, I think that that is part of the secret in this fight against this phenomenon that is critical and is a big concern, particularly for young people, because young people get their information in TikTok, which is instantaneous, very rapid. So how can we convey values of literacy to young people is definitely something that should concern us. And like the hummingbird, we should play our part. Thank you very much.
So we finished the session. We thank the participants and the speakers. See you soon, and thank you so much for this initiative.